the studio, I have Todd Graff, winemaker from Frank Family Vineyards, and Michael Davies, winemaker emeritus from A to Z and Rex Hill. You are the wine masters for this year's MSU Billings Foundation Wine and Food Festival. Thank you for being here to help the university raise monies for scholarships.
Oh, thank you for having us here, and it's our pleasure to be out here.
Absolutely. It's great to be in Billings.
Currently, Todd, you make wine in Napa Valley, and Michael, you're in the Willamette Valley. Let's start at the beginning. I want to know how you were introduced or inspired into going into the wine business. Did you grow up in an area that produced wines, or was it a subject in school that developed an interest? How and where did your affection for winemaking begin? I'll start with you, Todd.
Very simply, I grew up in Northern California, so I was aware of it, but no family connection at all. And I graduated from high school, and you got to think, what am I going to do, right? We have to make that tough decision, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I actually went to a local junior college before going to university, and I took an introductory class into grape growing and winemaking. The light bulb went on.
And Michael, for you, how did your beginnings start into the winemaking business?
Yeah, I had a pretty accidental introduction to wine or to the industry. I grew up the son of teachers. The only wine that we had in the house was in a box, and I don't even know if it was varietally specific. So I went through high school, did an economics and Scandinavian studies and politics undergraduate degree, which clearly doesn't lead towards winemaking. Tried a few different jobs. One day took a day off from when I was managing a youth hostel. So I went wine tasting. And as I went wine tasting for the day, I realized that I was actually very interested not in tasting the wine, but understanding the broader process, the growing of the grapes and what they did to get the wine in the bottle. So that was in Marlborough, New Zealand, back in 96, 95. And went to school a second time, got a postgraduate diploma in grape growing and winemaking, and haven't looked back. It's a very forgiving industry. It's accepted me after all. But it's also, I think, an industry where no matter what your skill and interest, there's something there for you.
It's obvious that the two of you saw those occasions and jumped in to take jobs or experiences to further your career in wine. Todd, can you talk a little bit more about your wine career?
Sure. So my brief history, graduated from UC Davis in California. I like to say one of the better known winemaking schools. And got into Napa Joseph Phelps, met international interns. And again, the light bulb went on and meeting these people. And they're saying, hey, you should come to our country. You should do this. I got to do vintages in Australia, then spent all that money in Australia. And then went into Asia backpacking, waiting for the sun to get over to Europe. And then got into Germany, worked a little there, then did a good harvest in Saint-Emilion in Bordeaux, France, and then came home, got a job at Stag's Leap Winery as an assistant winemaker, started working, and then travel bug kind of started itching again. And I was very fortunate. There's a pretty well-known winery in California called Schramsberg. They make sparkling wines. They were looking for a winemaker to start winery in Portugal and then be assistant winemaker in California, winemaker in Portugal. And then for the next 5 years, it's 2 months in Portugal, 2 months in Napa, 2 months, 2 months, 2 months. I did that for 5 years and then settled down, and then I took a job making sparkling wine for the Spanish in California, so instead of the Californians in Portugal. And then a light bulb came on again, where if you're going to be Napa, you better get into maybe some Cabernet. And so then I went to Frank Family, and that was over 20 years ago.
Wow, and you continue to travel.
I do get to travel. That's part of the fun of this. Michael said it last night really well. It's like, if you want to be alone, there's places you can go be alone in our industry, and it's yes. Our jobs. But if you want to be social, you have that opportunity too.
I really love that your jobs involve alone time and not alone time. Of course, I mostly love that you're around wine and food. Michael, what has your journey been?
Yeah, so I trained in New Zealand. Again, just a one-year course. It was a crash course, I suppose, in grape growing and winemaking. And then like so many others in this business, you chase harvests to get your break. You explore the world. So between earning money and living life and chasing girls, I got to work in Australia and California, France a little bit later. New Zealand is my home country. I came to Oregon in 99 thinking I was going to be there for about 3 months. And 25 years later, I'm still there. And now with the mortgage and 2 kids and an old car and golden Labrador to boot. So yeah, it's a good life.
I love that you both entered the industry pretty much in its golden years where it was developing and finding itself. When you talk about all the people you've worked with in the Napa Valley, you hit some of the major movers and shakers in the Napa Valley. And then you're coming over here from New Zealand and bringing the message and the winemaking processes from that area. I mean, it really was. You guys have been in these really good times of winemaking.
We feel very fortunate. I do. very fortunate that we were able to choose this as a career.
Absolutely. And I think the industry, it's changing ever so slightly. It's getting larger. It's getting more corporate. You know, there's a lot of personalities in the wine industry, and it's just wonderful to meet them and hopefully be one of them too.
Yeah. So. Well, I think you are, and you're kind of the path leaders here. So, Michael, during last night's seminar, you spoke of what intentions you wanted to capture in a bottle of wine. Can I begin with you to let me know what that means? What are you capturing in your wines, in your bottle?
So last night I was pouring one set of wines from Rex Hill Vineyards, and that's a brand that's been around since the early 80s. And it's a classic Willamette Valley brand in the sense of it's focused on Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, predominantly cool climate varieties. And we make about 10,000 cases, so it's a medium-sized winery, not tiny, not large. And I feel like it's a collector's style wine. It's a wine that is intended to be consumed and enjoyed, and it can be aged for quite a long time. The intention, really, with those wines is to capture in the bottle a time and a place. So we've got a season, whatever's happened during the growing season, and then we think about the mesa climates or even the microclimates to a degree where the grapes were growing and how every season's a little bit different. The soils are different. The age of the vine's different. The aspect of the vineyard is different. So you're really trying to capture in the bottle a reflection of that site, because wine is really a liquid manifestation or a memory, and one can get pretty geeky with that stuff. I feel like it's endlessly interesting, and you can learn a lot about the different soil types or the different weather patterns. But really, it's about creating a wine that people are going to enjoy and a wine that will age and continue to tell a different story as it ages. The other brand that I work a lot with is A to Z Wineworks, and the job there is a bit different. I feel like A to Z is one of the larger wine labels from Oregon, and my job is to really help introduce Oregon wine to people from all over the country. So it's not a simpler goal, but a purer goal in the sense of how do we capture the spirit of Oregon in the bottle? And I think about the landscape, the crazy wild coast, the beautiful mountains, the lakes, the verdant valleys, the Columbia Gorge, all those places that many of us have visited, but that really stick in our memories and, you know, have a freshness to them, have a vivid quality, have beautiful colors. That's what we want in the wine.
Wow, what a great answer. And I can see the visuals of that part of the world. I could also taste it in the glass, the pine trees, the ocean, the senses from the Willamette Valley. Todd, what about you? What do you hope to capture in a bottle of wine?
We're a Napa Valley brand, and much like Michael says, we're Napa, but Napa Valley's maybe 30 miles long, so it's not a big place, and a couple miles wide at the most, and then it goes up the hills. So our Chardonnay, our Pinot Noir is from the southern end, the Carneros region, so we're capturing that region. We focus on that AVA, so smaller growing unit. Napa Valley's broken up into several smaller growing units. Carneros being the coolest, predominantly where Chardonnay and Pinot Noir is grown. So we're focusing on that. And then Zinfandel is more of a Childs Valley blend, which is kind of an eastern finger of the Napa Valley. So another sub-appellation. And then the Bordeaux varietals, Cabernet being our largest red wine we produce, it's kind of Rutherford and Calistoga based. So again, centrally located. Even though it's Napa Valley, we're kind of breaking it up into parts of Napa Valley and putting that in our bottles.
It really is challenging work to be able to honor those places, because you could potentially just make wine just to have wine, that it doesn't have any personality. And I think it really showed in your wines last night, having side-by-side tastings of the Willamette Valley and Napa Valley. And those are two different areas.
Yeah, that's great. And that shows, too. I mean, two different areas, but wines can be great from everywhere. I mean, I'm a wine fan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as they say, when in Rome, for wherever I'm at, I'll try to find a Montana wine today. So we're not only working, but we're fans of the business, too.
I think the thing I would add, too, there, Stella, is as winemakers, get grapes once a year. We get one chance a year to help the wine tell a story. And we don't always get it right. It's a craft. We're not magicians. I love that challenge. I think often about chefs and how their job is to deliver amazing food every single night. I don't know how they do it, because for harvest in a grape context, I look forward to it. It's a highlight of the year. But I also need that downtime to sort of reflect, to think about what I may do differently next time.
That's really interesting, because I feel like a chef, if you don't do well one night, you always have tomorrow night. But when you have your harvest of grapes, you have that one chance And it's not for another 365 days that you can do that again. So if you screw up,
right.
Oh, it just makes me nervous.
No, I always say our pencils don't have erasers.
Right.
I love it. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
And some winemakers, of course, do chase harvest. You know, they'll do two a year, maybe even potentially three a year by traveling the globe. Again, depending on things going on in your life, that can be pretty taxing as well.
Yeah, it can be. So executive chef Sarah Savelt at the Northern Hotel last night created these bites that really paired well with your wines. When you make your wines, do you keep in the back of your mind that you want a wine to go with food? I'm going to start with you, Todd.
You know, actually, I don't think about food. I know I want the wine to be tasted along while you're eating and drinking wine, but I'm not really thinking, is this going to pair with the scallops like it did last night? You know, but Chardonnay on its own pretty much does if you're true to the variety. That's why it's such a classic match. We really want our wines to be balanced. We don't want it to be dominated by something that will stand out that doesn't go with food. So we are thinking that way, but I'm not really thinking I'm blending this Chard to go with scallops or something like that. I'm making it try to be the most balanced, delicious wine we can. And I'm very fortunate because our winemaking, it's not really a democracy. At the end of the day, you got to make a decision. And fortunately, it's an easy decision if you just pick what you like. And fortunately, we have a lot of customers that seem to like it too. So it's a win-win that way.
Yeah, it is. What about you, Michael? Do you make wines to pair with food?
I completely agree with Todd. I feel like we want our wines to be food friendly. We expect people to enjoy the wine with food and with company. The wines are part of the environment, part of the experience. They're not the experience. But I try not to have too many preconceived ideas of which food is going to be consumed when we're making the wine. I like to be surprised, in fact. You know, I think this is the classic idea that white wines go with chicken and red wines go with beef. And I believe we're beyond that. There's so much more opportunity to experiment. I mean, try things. And if it doesn't work, then you know for next time. Some of the best steak meals I've ever had, I've enjoyed Chardonnay more than a Pinot or a Cabernet. And then at the winery, what we often do to sort of demystify sometimes wine and food pairings, or to diminish the idea that there's only one answer, is we'll do something as simple as a potato chip tasting. And you bring out the varieties and six different bags of chips, and it's fascinating.
Oh, I love that. Potato chip tasting with wines. I asked that question because I believe that wines have become, I believe, more balanced. I think there's more acidity. You talked about last night, that eye closing, that wines do have that acidity in it that does pair better with food.
Mm-hmm.
And chefs also are becoming more sophisticated in their abilities to pair wine with food. So that's the evolution that I believe I'm seeing. Todd, you've been with Frank Family for 20 years. How have you seen the making of wines change over that time?
So we're always constantly evolving, but at the heart of it also, we've been making wine the same way we made it 200 years ago. At grow grape, you get some juice, you ferment it, you get it into a bottle. But now we're better farmers, we're better stewards of the land. I think when I started, you basically say there was the winemaker in the winery and the grape grower out there. Now you don't know who's who anymore. Now the vineyard manager's in the winery a lot of times, I hope, and the winemaker's in the vineyard all the time. I always say we're cutting edge 1980 still kind of in the wine industry, but our equipment is getting better. Technology's coming along. We still want to have this handcrafted product, but great equipment to do the pressing of the wines, to do the destemming of the wines. We have more information available. It's a global industry, so I mean, it's not hard to pick up the phone and call a friend in Australia and say, hey, what do you guys do with this situation? So it's a big world, really small community of wine. So that hasn't changed. But again, I would say, you know, as a stereotypical answer would be, you'd make a Cabernet and you couldn't drink it for 15 years. You needed that time. Well, now because of this equipment, because of the talent has changed a little bit to the grape growing, it's a little bit of a cliche, but the wines do taste good when they're bottled, and they can age the 10 to 20 years also.
That's a great answer. I love that the younger wines are more approachable. Michael, what do you think has changed over the years in winemaking?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, I came to Oregon in 99, and when I arrived, I remember working in the cellar one time at a winery and finding an old price list from the 80s in Oregon. And in Oregon, it had Cabernet, Riesling, and Chardonnay were the main varieties. Oregon basically still makes a decent amount of Riesling, but Cabernet doesn't really exist much in the Willamette Valley. And I think what we realized is a region can't just copy another region. It can't assume that what one region does well will automatically transfer. And that's why we've seen such incredible growth of Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris and Chardonnay now more recently in the Willamette Valley. And I think that's the exciting part, where you borrow an idea from somewhere else, you try it, and then you pivot and you experiment. And I agree with Todd again, where winemaking to me is a very tradition-bound industry, but new ideas and technology can come from anywhere. And it's great to have the time to think about which part of something might bring something new and exciting and dynamic. Because we live in a very modern world. Even though it's tradition bound, we've got to be innovative. There's a lot of competition. There's more competition out there, and competition of good wines. Think back in the day, maybe a long time ago, there was a lot of variability in quality. Now, a lot of choices for consumers.
You cannot sell a bad wine these days, I believe. The consumers pick up on it, and I don't think your lifespan is going to be very long, unfortunately.
Right. Oh, it's fun for us, too, because we kind of play in the top of the pyramid. So the competition is fun, but it's friendly rivalries. Mm-hmm. You know, the wine industry is a unique industry where I'm guessing that if you work for Apple, you probably don't have a lot of Microsoft products.
Right.
But as a winemaker, I have Oregon Pinot in my cellar. You know, when I go out to dinner, I'm buying somebody else's wine because I want to try it.
In the same way, I mean, we love having visitors to the winery, whether it's customers or whether it's colleagues. And we're happy to share what we do, what we think, what mistakes we've made. We get better that way. We learn together.
I love that camaraderie and that sharing. You used this in your talk last night, Michael. In making wine, what do you geek out about? You use that word geek.
I geek out about various aspects of the science of winemaking. I probably could spend more time geeking out about the creative side, you know, just the purely the philosophical or the intention side. But I love understanding more and more, better and better, the different soil types. I think most winemakers become amateur meteorologists during harvest. The grapes are vulnerable to what's going to happen, whether it's hail, whether it's rain, whether it's sunshine, whether it's pests. So I think the geeking out can be at a chemistry level of understanding what bacteria might be doing a secondary fermentation in a barrel. It can be understanding yeasts and how a yeast works, how if you do native fermentation, so you don't choose to add a yeast, which is how we make our Rex Hill wines, how the selection or the diversity of yeasts is going to be different than if you add a yeast out of a bag.
I so love that winemaking is the combination of art and science. Todd, what do you geek out about?
I think my geek out time is usually blending, sitting alone in the, I have a little bar in the lab, so it's nothing fancy, but you know, and that's where is that 1% of Petit Verdot making a difference and putting these blends together, walking away, coming back, doing it again in the morning, you know, or taking it home and drinking it with meal that night and just playing with the blends. That's probably where I'm doing my geeking out and just sitting by myself. You know, you'll get that one shot to put it in the bottle. Once the cork's in there, you're done.
You're right. Blending is such an amazing part of the year. I mean, harvest I love for a different reason. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of decisions that are needed in a timely manner. There's great intensity. You've got a lot of energy with new people around you, often from all over the world. So it's a really dynamic, exciting time, harvest. But the blending time is hard to beat as well, because it's so contemplative, it's so personal, and you're generally not under as much time pressure. You can
take the time you want.
You can revisit a decision.
Have you gotten to the point, because you've been in the business for so long, I feel like sometimes when I'm cooking, because I've cooked a long time in my life, can you actually taste the different tubes or bottles or combinations that's in front of you, and you can almost picture or taste that wine, the final product in your head?
For me, yes. But the great thing about it is, like, for example, for Cabernet Sauvignon, I'm living with that wine for almost 2 years. Let's talk about a child. You know it from the day it came home, basically, and you watched it crawl, walk, run, and obviously 2 years. But so by the time you're getting ready to blend also, you know what direction that child's going to go. You've raised it. If you did your job right, you know you're going to let it go off into the world. A little corny, but true. You're not doing it all brand new and one day. This is a 2-year process of blending. We do a Bordeaux red blend that we try to use a lot of varietals in it. It's a puzzle. Sometimes you go home and you're lying staring at the ceiling in bed going, I'm missing that one piece. I don't know where I'm going to find it. And then all of a sudden the light bulb comes on. You found that piece to put in there. And then that's fun.
And isn't it amazing when those ideas just all suddenly come together?
I like that parenting metaphor there. I think that's really profound. And as a winemaker with a deep experience, you know, we're tasting wines in their youth, often quite young. We know the consumer's not going to taste them for a couple of years later. We're trying to anticipate what the wine's going to taste like 10 years later, 15 years later. And I think that experience that we both have gives us more confidence that we know where it might be going. to me, a lot of the immediate tasting that we do is sort of fairly technical, but it's almost intuitive, the next part.
When I think of the parent example, it's like, as with kids, you know, don't take too much credit, don't take too much blame.
Right.
Do the best you can. But, you know, when your kids do a fantastic job, yeah, you were there, but they did it. And if your kid picks up a rock and throws it through the window, that wasn't your fault either, you know? And I treat the wines kind of like that. Just do the best you can, shepherd them as best you can. And
to add something else, I feel like, you know, you've got to personally reconcile how much risk you want to take on board. If you play it safe, the wines are just not going to be as interesting. They're not going to be as compelling. So, you know, whereas if you swing for the fence every single time, you're going to be disappointed too many times. So it's sort of knowing when to take the risk, knowing when to push, knowing when to just be content with what you have.
Yeah, I love that child metaphor, and that's Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours plus that
yes,
you put the time in.
Exactly.
So last night at the Wine Master Soiree, I noticed that there was a pretty diverse crowd there eating with us and drinking with us. Who is drinking the most wine these days, and where? What ages are enjoying
wine? Besides
wines?
Michael and I.
Yes, and me.
Yeah, Great question. We ask ourselves that all the time, too. Who's Frank Family Vineyards customer? And we don't have a marketing team doing a study. What we do is we have a very successful tasting room on the property, and we just keep our eyes open, really, and we can see. And obviously, you could read a lot of articles about the boomer generation. They're shrinking, and the next generation has so many other options. But I love sitting around our taste room. You watch the 20-somethings, the 30s, the 40s. We're pretty fortunate because Frank Family's got a lot of energy right now. And for some reason, everybody thinks they discovered it. They all have a personal story with it. It's nothing better than probably having a 20-year-old, their parents buying it and having it for Thanksgiving or Christmas. And then now that's their wine. Or when I see parents, as soon as their kids turn 21, they buy them a wine club membership, things like that. That's fun.
Yeah. Michael, what about you?
Yeah. I think wine is one of those universal products, things that people enjoy at all sorts of ages. I feel like a lot of articles or the traditional ideas that a lot of boomers are the ones with the most capital to spend on wine, they're possibly the most loyal to brands too compared to millennials. But I think even that's changing. I think millennials have different priorities. They have different concerns. Maybe they care more about knowing a company's environmental practices or labor practices. And it's all valid. You know, I think what better way, just like Todd was saying, a boomer can open a bottle of wine with their grandchild or certainly their own children, and it brings conversation forward. It gives another topic to talk about and experience and enjoy together, and to be honest, disagree sometimes, because disagreement is fine. You know, I think it's how we learn. It's how we get to know each other even better.
Oh, that's a great answer. I guess what I expected was there's big seltzer sales and people are not drinking wine. The younger generation isn't touching wine. Or are you creating wine appeals to them?
Well, no. I don't make wine focusing on a generation. But it's not that long ago that I was that generation of coming in and I was drinking beer. And I'm old enough to remember California Coolers and Bartles and James. So we had other competition for the wine. But then, you know what I love? That's your introductory into this beverage world, and next thing you're trading that California cooler for a Chardonnay or a Zinfandel or something. So, you know, there's more options. They have that, but I think one introduces them to another also. And I'm not sure they're going to be drinking whatever's hot right now. Might not be that hot in 10 years.
Yeah,
for them.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, I mean, a cannabis-infused coffee with a high oxygen quota might be trendy today. But I think one of the beautiful things about wine, at least for me, it's directly attached to agricultural product. Therefore, it's attached to a place and it's attached to a traditional craft. So I think wine is going to stick around. I think it makes sense. We live in a very fast-paced world where people are looking for new things and exciting things. But I want to believe that there's always going to be a place for, you know, true, traditionally made classic wines.
We always have a saying too, right? It takes a lot of beer to make good wine.
That's right.
You know, so it's just because I love wine. But that doesn't mean I don't want a beer once in a while either.
Yeah.
Or a margarita or scotch.
God dang it. If you look in my liquor cabinet. Yeah.
Something spirited and good. All right. You brought this up, and this is the final question. Sustainability. That is, sustainable is the big word these days. Just briefly, give me some examples as to what your winery is doing to make the business, the people, the grapes, the wine sustainable. I'm going to start with Michael.
In terms of sustainability, our Rex Hill estate vineyards are all farmed biodynamically. Biodynamics to me is an extension of, and maybe even the forebearer to, organic growing of products. The biodynamic tutor that I went through a course with, he challenged us to lift our powers of observation in the vineyard, or the winery for that matter, but particularly the vineyard, tenfold. And if we think about lifting our powers of observation tenfold in any area of life, you see a lot more, you learn a lot more. So biodynamics is a powerful thing. It's almost like homeopathy in medicine, where you are seeding and signaling to the vines what you want the vines to do, rather than trying to dominate them or beat them into submission. I find it's a very forgiving way of raising grapes and growing grapes. So that's at a earth level or a agricultural level. We also, of course, work within organic parameters, and then there's various sustainability programs in the wine industry. An Oregon homegrown one is called LIVE, and that stands for Low Input Viticulture and Enology. The idea there is we are very judicious about any fertilizers that we're using, judicious about any herbicides that someone might choose to use, judicious about basically everything. The other thing that A to Z Wineworks, that owns Rex Hill, has been active with more recently is we're a B Corp. B Corp is basically an integrated way of operating as a business, where the mandate of the business, the direction of the business, is to take into consideration the well-being of the community, the employees, the products, the environment, the air. So it's a very holistic approach. Yet again, A to Z has become a silver member of this. It's the IWCA, International Winery Climate Action Group, where we are trying to work out how we can do better and better, because climate change is a real thing from my perspective. There's a movement towards lighter bottles, thinking about how we can make sure we have our people fully trained, we have housing that they can afford to live where we need them to work, that we've got good representation of across genders, across minorities. You know, it's the whole deal. Sustainability is here to stay.
That is fantastic. So you can move things into the future. Todd, what is Frank Family Vineyards doing for sustainability?
So we belong to an organization in Napa Valley. It's called Napa Green. It's the improvement every year that we're trying to be realistic about. We're not trying to go from 0 to 100 in 1 year, but we do want to go 10, 20, 30. And then in 10 years, we're really good. So a lot of it for us is metering, putting meters on wells. So, okay, if we used 100 water units, whatever that number is, hopefully we're going to use 95 next year. We've eliminated certain herbicides in the vineyards. So sustainability, Michael talked about it. It's not just crops. It's not just the environment. It's the people. We want to protect that. At Frank Family, we're in a process right now of extra insulation on the roofs. We're putting it all solar. We have another product called Fish Friendly Farming, where the Napa River comes through the valley. Everybody who owns property on that helped clean up the river, and we're trying to bring the native species back. But for us, it's energy efficiency really right now and reduced applications in the vineyards.
Oh, I love the answers. I love what you're doing. I have asked you many questions. You've been very patient early this morning. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want to share with the listeners?
Please come and visit in both in the Willamette Valley of Oregon and Napa Valley. There's always something new and exciting to see and taste. Harvest particularly is the best time of year to visit. You'll even get put on a forklift if you're qualified.
Yeah, that's a pitch for anybody want to work harvest? Come see us. No, and you'd love it. I mean, I'm best friends with the people I worked my first harvest with. I'd like everybody to know it's a lifestyle. This isn't just a job. And luckier than heck that I picked it.
For sure.
Todd, Michael, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Stella.
Many thanks to Todd Graff of Frank Family Vineyards and Michael Davies of Rex Hill and A to Z Wines for joining me in the studio. Much gratitude to their help in raising scholarships for the MSU Billings Foundation. Music for Flavors in the Big Sky was provided by Parker Brown. Thanks to you, listeners, for your support. I'm Stella Fong.